You go down this cliff, go left down the cliff, yeah. Left, and then just tumble for a while, and then you should be there.
My truth is the truth that you will never understand.
Private ownership is one single individual giving green light. Doesn't that tell you that your system is more akin to authoritarian dictatorship?
No, we had a king. I thought we were an autonomous collective.
What the heck is a D? How come he can buy our house when it's our house and we live there?
Just when these American citizens needed their rights the most, their government took them away. The rights aren't rights if someone could take them away.
They have every man in a straitjacket. To leave a country is like breaking out of jail. And to enter a country is like going through the eye of a needle.
I don't know if you've noticed, but our two-party system is a bowl of shit looking in the mirror at itself.
Shout out! Revolution!
Police Academy essentially opens up policing to the citizens. It's a pretty anarchic idea for an 80s movie.
We're not only going strike, but we need to fire the bosses. This whole you getting paid more, doing less work thing, it's not working out, Steve.
Welcome to this live edition of the Three Left Show. I'm your host, Dan Platt, here in the studio. Let me get my bearings. I've been planning out the next 2 hours of alternative, radical, leftist talk and storytelling and news coverage from a different perspective. That is what the Three Lefts is about. It is up to me how the direction of this show actually goes. Of course, you as well with input. So give me input via Twitter, Facebook, and other means. Website, threelefts.news. Social media's Three Left Show. Also on YouTube, though I don't post videos there. But it is accessible. And I will get notifications. So I'm Dan Platt, activist know-it-all of Albany, New York. Thinking about how to disrupt the status quo. And what kind of campaign is needed. But first, word on unrest. I think I want to talk about unrest before I get into the ecological theme. I think more of my episodes, especially in the summer, maybe because it's summer, thinking about nature, thinking about how we treat nature, thinking about climate catastrophe and the climate emergency. And as it comes upon us and it affects other parts of the world. Example, Jakarta, capital of Indonesia, is the government is planning on moving the capital because the capital, the city of Jakarta, is sinking. It has become too large and verbose, and they are planning on moving it to Borneo. Wonderful. Moving whole cities, places of seat of government and all that, because their city is sinking into the ocean. Now, other rim world, sometimes it's called, the third world, the developing world, it's hitting there because they are more vulnerable, less developed, their infrastructure. As bad as our infrastructure is, it's still at least here and already and aged and matured. But it has not yet hit us, the catastrophe, the emergency. More of us are talking about it. More of us are noticing it. The Arctic, the Amazon. And I have lost track of the story I saved, but also the jungles in Africa are also on fire. This is a global problem. This is not just in California, it's not just in the Amazons. Why is there not more unrest in America? Or what does it take for there to be unrest? Unrest is how real categorical social change does happen, although so many fear it for good reason, but also because they fear it because they have a life, we, including myself, have lives that are comfortable enough. We can still go to the bank and get money and pay for things. When that ceases to happen, let's say climate catastrophe causes the next recession, or run on the bank, or a complete drop in the value of money, then we will see more unrest. We need to be squeezed from multiple sides. Our lives, as depressing and anxious as they make us, and alienating, we seem to not be at the edge yet. Life is still somewhat more bearable, maybe because of Netflix, and maybe because of drugs and medications. But when these things become inaccessible, I think people are starting to go and break down more. Now, maybe in America, because of our individualism, the reaction is suicide or self-destruction instead of the destruction of the institutions that harm us, that oppress us. So there's a bit of a, you know, complexity there of not knowing what will happen. And we got to accept that. But say in Hong Kong and in France with the yellow vests, unrest takes many forms. It's a mistake to kind of look at these conflicts as being one side against another side. Ideologically speaking, if we view the Hong Kong protests as a socialist mainland China against a capitalist Hong Kong, I'm actually going to side with Beijing, right? But it's more than that. You have state power of mainland China against the state power of Hong Kong and capitalists in Hong Kong, but also the working class of Hong Kong. Look up the story, but I'll do that during my next break, so I'll focus on the Amazon side of global news from the last month. And perhaps the not talked about enough, vegans will certainly mention it, and I'm mostly a vegan, I'm certainly in solidarity with them, and I'm also accepting of the reality that we need to go more vegetarian if we are to actually address the inequalities of our world, not only environmentally speaking, but socially. To oppress animals is also to oppress our fellow man. To dehumanize one type of life, to commodify it, is to commodify all mankind. Just as no man is, I am not free if any other man is not free, that same goes for life. It's a universal concept to me. So here is a story from The Guardian. The Guardian UK newspaper, as they put in their call for donations / subscriptions, point out that they have actually put in the resources to cover climate issues overall because, rightfully, it is the most important issue of our times. Thus, they have sent out the actual people to look into the reason the Amazons are burning, which is for livestock production, for cattle raising. It takes a lot of land. In America, we have tons of land. The Midwest, grain, the plains, the Great Plains. They are the Great Plains. Brazil doesn't have Great Plains. But if they're going to have a hamburger week like we do, or have a first world economy, then they need their own Great Plains. And if they're just going to make them, they're going to cut down the forests. They're going to pave the savanna in Brazil. So revealed, rampant deforestation of Amazon driven by global greed for meat. Now, this is a pretty long article. I'm going to focus on certain aspects of it. I think I'll just start with the first few paragraphs and then move on. An investigation exposes how Brazil's huge beef sector continues to threaten health of world's largest rainforest. Another point made by, a scientific article I saw on my Facebook feed this morning was that although, there are points... Coverage seems to mention the global oxygen supply. That's not really how this works. The burning of the Amazon and other forests, any kind of forest, threatens biodiversity and accelerates climate change, but not quite threatens the oxygen supply. There's quite a bit more there than just in and out with the amount of oxygen created, since air is only a small percentage oxygen, so it's not really the right way of talking about that. The cows grazed under the midday Amazon sun, near a wooden bridge spanning a river. His idyllic scene of pastoral quiet, occasionally broken by a motorbike growling on a dirt road. But this pasture is land that is a farm that is forbidden for use for cattle since 2010, when it was embargoed by Brazil's government environmental agency, IBAMA, for illegal deforestation. So it basically goes into how their environmental agency, created by the left-ish government of the pink tide of Lula, created an environmental agency that basically tries to cordon off enough of the rainforest to deforestation, to basically say, don't develop this. This Israeli followed. Their main tool seems to be fining companies. They don't jail anybody. I think that's a problem. It mentions the company Agro SB, known as Santa Barbara, located in that area. So... basically, the farmers out here are just kind of plucky environment, entrepreneurial go-getters, who would support Bolsonaro, kind of just looking after their own interests, their ability to create wealth for themselves. And basically, the article goes back and forth between the point of view of these big agro business companies that buy cattle from these smaller ranchers and how they say they're following all the regulations. Now, not mentioned in this article is, well, Are the regulations tailored for the companies? Do the companies not have a pull, lobbying or otherwise, of the regulations? Do they even, by the force of their capital, have to even follow these? Also, they could not follow them, pay the fines, and just go on business as usual, which many companies in America do. As in the case with, say, BP and the oil spill in the Gulf. They just paid a few billion dollars, and we'll just be on our way. Many of these small farmers point out that they're just using a little bit of land. They're just deforesting a little bit. Okay, we'll multiply that small farmer slash cattle rancher by a few million, and you have half of the Amazon level. And rainforest takes a very long time to regrow because it is a very complicated slash dense interdependent ecosystem. It can come back. It is resilient. So memes about how, like, there was a meme with the Paris Cathedral, the Notre Dame. This can be rebuilt easily. It can be rebuilt. And donations of billions came in to fix it, from the world's elite. But only, well, let's just say the global reaction and the donations for the firefighting efforts has been very paltry. And there have been many point out on social media what it compares to, like the $22 million raised globally, is the price of one highway bridge or the price of this infrastructure project in America. It's a paltry number. It's not saying we should spend it on the Amazon and not this, but of course we should for our sake of global climate. But we should just be able to spend the money anyway. The global elite, the 1%, will pay to rebuild Notre Dame. And the meme will say we can't rebuild Amazon. Now I'll go into how we could, and we absolutely can. Forests and life is resilient. We just have to stop. We just have to take our boot off of it. That goes for people too. Oh yeah, it goes into how, like, you know, there's this growing wealth. They're doing horse racing in this little town. It wasn't a highway, blah blah blah. Development, you know, the American dream. Let's see, there's some small paragraphs here about the growing global demand of, is part of the global supply chain of beef to China and Hong Kong, for example, as well as Europe. Let's see. Here are some numbers. Because of the high volume Brazilian beef shipped to China and Hong Kong, these markets are associated with the highest amount of deforestation in total, between 17,000 and 26,000 hectares per year. The EU also imports more than 600 million worth of beef from Brazil. And that will increase if the EU and member states approve a new trade deal with Brazil, as well as other South American countries, to gradually let 99,000 tons of low-tariff South American beef into Europe every year. That is actually how it ends. So the demand continues, and thus, demand needs to stop if we want the, say, market incentives to destroy the rainforest to continue. Now, Brazilian beef isn't going to America. We have our own massive cattle industry for that. But there's a lot of ecosystem in the Midwest that could use rehabilitation. That isn't going to happen until we decrease meat consumption. I've covered how it has slightly gone down, but it's still kind of a drop in the bucket. As well as, say, one new vegan, 20 more meat eaters. There's so many alternatives, and meat is something never really needed, at least our modern lives we don't need. So any naturalistic argument can just get the hell out of here. Since I'm talking about food, but let's go into the forest. The Miyawaka method, a better way to build forests. This is from the J Daily, where news meets a scholarly match. Let's see, India's forest production company is following the tenets of a master Japanese botanist, restoring biodiversity in a resource depleted community. In 2010, let's see, this was published this year by Leah Nargri. In 2010, Shurabiyu Shwama cleared the grass from this 75 square meter backyard. And a side note, this is my first time reading this, so I will be doing it a little slowly with a lot of pauses. He cleared his backyard and his family home in the city of Kashmipur in India's Himalayan state. And in the intensely compacted soil, he planted 224 saplings and some 19 species of shrubs and trees, timber and guava and mulberry, among other fruit trees. Then he weeded and watered and monitored. He watched as the young, frail plants leafed and flowered. quickly growing tall and thick as a dozen species of birds moved into the newly lush habitat. As a thermometer registered coolness between the trees, a difference of some 5 degrees Celsius, that's nearly 15 Fahrenheit, from the surrounding air, even in June's blistering heat. In August, monsoon rains, which once puddled on the surface of the yard, absorbed into the dirt like a sponge, says the farmer. In a year, his backyard has become a self-sustaining mini-forest. Planting it was an odd pursuit, given that Sharma has never been particularly interested or drawn to studies or work involving flora. He made his living as an industrial engineer, a career he had dreamed of, in fact, since his boyhood. It's certainly a career that too many of our young people are pushed into, with promises of STEM salaries. But in 2009, while working on assembly line and dispatch systems at a Toyota plant, Shawarma was captivated by a presentation given by Akira Miyawaka, the Blue Planet award-winning botanist from Japan, is celebrated for his very particular approach to afforestation, a soil, air, water, and climate remediating process by which trees are planted where no trees existed before. He'd come to apply his method to a tract of land around a factory where Shawarma worked. Shawarma volunteered to help place over 32,000 native trees and plants like neem, mango, and teak into the otherwise industrial landscape, and from the day on, his fate was sealed. In 2011, after proving that Miyawaka's method could work for its own experimental backyard forest, he quit his job at Toyota and opened a forest production company called A-Forest, with two T's, which practices that method, what he preaches. The introduction to a depleted landscape of potential natural vegetation, which is what would naturally occur in that particular place without human intervention. Since then, A-Forest has planted over about 500,000 trees in 144 tiny fast-growing forests in 50 cities. This is quite the operation. Afforestation basics. It's no secret that Earth is rapidly losing its forests. Just between 1990 and 2015, the world lost 129 million hectares, which equals 2 Texases. As the Washington Post puts it, deforestation is responsible for an estimated 5 billion tons, or 17% of the annual global carbon emissions, not to mention soil erosion and biodiversity loss. In contrast, growing forests have numerous benefits. Forests remove vast amounts of carbon from the air. They store it, so on. Tropical forests alone store a quarter, so it talks about carbon sequestration, as it's called. Forests cool the air and generate oxygen, plus they clean water. They also house 80% of the biodiversity, reduce soil erosion, halt desertification, and lessen the impacts of floods. So there's a local problem. And Albany does not have, we have a few like forests on the edges of Albany, but we need a forest in the middle of Albany because we have flooding right in the middle of our city. And I think demolishing a block or two and planting a forest in its place would lessen the flooding and then allow for more dense housing in other areas of the city. So it wouldn't be housing lost, but it needs to be a redistribution of where the housing is. Let's see. Recognizing the essentialness of forests, the UN's International Union of Conservation of Nature and the German government. Man, too many of these articles have too many long NGO names. I think I'm getting to the point. Historically, however, afforestation was largely seen as a means to generate income from timber and other products. So these kind of projects often favor plantations of single species like, Monterey pine, sika spruce, or oil palms. Many of the Bond Challenge projects follow the same monoculture approach. Monoculture is where you just plant one thing, which has its pros and cons. Monoculture forests have carbon benefits. A project drawdown points out that they have often created with purely economic motives and little regard for long-term well-being of the land. It also calls them ecological deserts, as a stand of only pines, for example, does little to promote multi-species plant animal diversity found in natural forests. Monocultures of trees can also cause harm. 2008, just mentioning that they are susceptible to, say, bug attack and disease. A species notorious for contributing to droughts in water-scarce places, which left experts worrying about the potential effects. Miyawaka method, as a young graduate student in the late 50s, he emerged. Okay, so basically it just goes into the history of it, how he learned it around the shrines of his homeland. It uses an algorithm. But basically, this has another word for this called permaculture. And to me, it's the future of all agriculture. I think I get a hard pushback whenever if I mention we need to stop using pesticides. I think I could rephrase it to make it a little more palatable and say we need to use less pesticides. Let's say let's stop using them for golf courses and private lawns. Let's get rid of lawns altogether, let's be honest. But there's a contention that we cannot grow enough food if we do not use pesticides and basically poison the earth and ourselves, because these things don't break down. All right. And let's say we're not, like, say we filter all the water we drink. What about the water that goes through our shower heads? I saw an ad from the Home Depot about a shower head that basically has a water filter in it. A personal individual solution for a structural systemic problem. Because it just, we can't stop using pesticides. But there are so many agricultural solutions to this. Permaculture is one of them. You plant a diversity of things, which includes predators. Predators that then eat the pests. The thing about the necessity of pesticides is that there are all these bugs and things that eat the crops. Why is there the abundance of these pests? Because there are no predators. Why are there no predators? Because the ecosystem that supports them, that gives them shelter, was mysteriously disappeared. Put some of it back, and then you can restore that ecosystem, keep the pests, the prey species under control. It's also just a matter of forest management where you just set an amount of ecosystem aside for pests to live in. They live there. They do not expand because, unlike humanity, they don't have to keep growing until there's nothing else. There is a limit. And that's the thing about limits. They force us to share and think creatively. If we put no limit on the amount of pesticides and poisons we put on ourselves, then, of course, there is no solution. There does not need to be one. Only a solution to the inconveniences of these industrial solutions, like replacing our shower heads with filters and eczema creams, so on. Okay. From Culture Hub, with a K, Culture with a K, which I guess is like a hip-hop channel. But why would I reference this? So the story is, how an eco-socialist rapper No Name is using her platform for good. This is a very short one. Follow up that mess of an article. Following several philanthropic headlines featuring Jay-Z, No Name, a conscious rapper, took to Twitter to express her stance on giving back. She called for Jay-Z to partner with some black-owned worker co-ops. Responses to the tweet were disapproving of the idea, pointing out Jay-Z's history of helping the black community. That's when No Name made a pointed observation. Capitalism facilitates oppression, and therefore cannot facilitate true liberation. Now it's maddening to see, let's see, millionaire/billionaire blackpreneurs, Oprah, Jay-Z, Kanye West, they hang out with other rich people. They like Trump. They have their own class interests now, but they still tweet as if they are making some kind of fast social change and actually having an impact beyond the ecosystem of community groups on the ground that are grassroots and actually empowering. But they tweet like they say, like, they're the revolution. What is this, a revolution of black millionaires? So it's but a revolution of black millionaires against white millionaires, basically. And that's the conflict. It's not, and everyone else is just left out of it. So here's a tweet. The tweet from No Name. You can't uplift people with the same tool, capitalism, that stripped them of their humanity in the first place. I get where he's coming from. I used to think like that too. They teach us, think like that, but we can learn new models on how to support each other. Worker co-ops. What is a co-op? For the uninitiated, No Name doesn't just talk the talk, she makes moves. People work with co-ops in Jackson, Mississippi. Also, the meta project of that is called Cooperative Jackson. A co-op comes from the word cooperative, and the people involved do just that. People come together to work on providing a service and reap the benefits and profits together, as opposed to an owner making the money from other people's labor. According to StrongerTogether.coop, a cooperative exists to serve its members, but what makes co-ops unique is that the members are also the owners. So in addition to getting the products and services you need, you also have to say, you have a say in the business. These decisions that your cooperative makes. Now, worker co-op focuses on empowering workers. A consumer co-op means that the buyers have a say in what the co-op is doing. Ideally, both have a seat at the table. That is who the board members would be. The point is, the co-op structure is a truly democratic way of dispersing and sharing wealth and resources. These guys are building a network of worker co-ops directly in the middle of one of the most disenfranchised neighborhoods in Jackson, Mississippi, providing resources, fresh produce, and eventually affordable housing. I will support y'all. Another tweet from No Name. Another. Still can't get over my time spent in Mississippi this past weekend. This is the grocery unit that, at Cooperative Jackson, purchased right in the middle of the hood. They will have a farmer's market in here with organic produce grown exclusively by black farmers in the South. Doing the work. If you couldn't tell from her post, No Name supports systems that are outside of capitalist structures and preferably renewable, placing emphasis on how capitalism has created oppressive structures and then feeds off of them. This is called eco-socialism. More or less. Historical knowledge is important in order to understand just how invasively powerful capitalism and the oppression of people of color in the black community specifically. Her newly formed book club is particularly adept at recommending works that provide insights into the past and present and future of conscious activism. Her Twitter is just No Name. No Name originally rose to fame for her music, a master lyricist. She came up with fellow artist Chance the Rapper. Now, Sis is continuing to produce music, but is using her platform for social change and economic revolution. Stop sleeping on No Name. And then has a tweet with her just saying, pussy, pussy, liberate all disenfranchised pussy people, also pussy, pussy, pussy. So I'll take a break and play for you a track from hers, of hers. Enjoy.
Opportunity knocking, a nigga was out for coffee. Inadequate like my window, the Grammys is way too lofty. And I could stay here forever, I could die here. I don't have to try here. Can I get my two sugars, please? Jesus made an album, I'm still waiting in a line for cream. She dreaming Technicolor, lip black and white. Opportunity knocking, a nigga just got her nails. No skeletons in my closet, gonna open the door when Yale come. They ain't gonna wanna see my silhouette rap. He's fucking cognac, I'm smelling all black. Mississippi vagabond, granny gon' turn up in her grave and say my granny really was a slave for this. All your incomplete similes and pages ripped, you know they whipped us niggas. How you afraid to rap and you look to heaven after so we can freedom now. Ain't no ocean floor when you can be a Jesus now.
Don't feel the life that wears.
Moments and cloudy days on my snap. Mysterious aberration illuminated the trap. My telephone calculation synonymous with the sunrise. Mountains against the foreground forever me coming back. I ain't gonna cry the last time I leave my Chicago. 24 in LA, Mojo teaching me how to drive. Whole world inside my rear view, this feeling me so alive. This feeling me so alive, enjoy the joy ride. Opportunity knocking, it's finally time to answer. The doorbell was only broken cause auntie was fighting cancer. And cigarettes on my mantle, keep calling me by my first name. Loving me when I'm lonely, pretending they really know me.
Don't feel the life that dwells deep within. You are powerful.
Thirst. So you're just listening to a track of No Name called Reality. So this is the Three Left Show. I'm your host, Dan Platt. Trying to get back in the groove. Very unorganized with the number, because I just have so many stories. I didn't even figure out what the best order of them were, especially since there's just so many things to talk about. So I'm just going to continue on the food ecology, growing different kind of nature kind of kick here. Here's a story from Global News in Canada this month. Bee population recovering due to regenerative farming, producers say, by Nathaniel Dove. Paul Kennergrogan says restorative agriculture has brought bees back to his farm. Now, first, a little background, because this article doesn't bring that to the bear. So, what I mentioned before about building ecosystems that then actually either maintains or even increases the yields over industrial agriculture is generally called restorative agriculture. Restoring ecosystems, restoring the land, instead of just extracting surplus value from it. Because it's creating dead landscapes and eventually will destroy us. It doesn't look that way now in our state of abundance. But historically speaking, looking at past civilizations, they had boom times and surpluses for a generation or two. And then the land would simply run out. It would hit its limit. And there was no technology that they could have developed, no new technique, except to restore the land. But they didn't have the knowledge we do, and thus the choice, to restore the environment before we completely deplete it and destroy it. Otherwise, we have to let nature restore it, and that takes a few generations on its own. But we can help that out by helping that along by using techniques like the afforestation mentioned before the break. So here's restorative farming in practice with a small farmer. With a flowering species of plants we now have, you definitely see more, he said, bees, referring to bees. He's referring to a mixture of plants in his fields near Birch Hills, Saskatchewan. Along with his partner, Aaron Dancy, he now grows flowers like red clover, Placea and sunflowers, along with barley, oats, and peas. They grow to feed their dairy cattle. This is a dairy farm, but it could be any kind of farm. So it goes into the cows a bit. So the couple manage their fields with regenerative agriculture. They said the practice has brought greater profits, efficiency, and higher bee population. Regenerative agriculture, says Cover Crops Canada spokesperson Kevin Elmy, is designed to replenish the biology of our soils. We've mined our soils, and our soil is going in the wrong direction, he says. We've lost about two-thirds of organic matter in our soils. It's time to build it back. Elmy says the mixture of different crops, which bloom at different times and grow at different rates, replenishes the nutrients and bacteria necessary for the soil to be fertile. And he says that the flowers have encouraged the bees to repopulate. Kerrigan said that there were lots of bees when he was growing up before they all but disappeared around 10 years ago, coinciding with the use of new types of pesticides. It's encouraging, he said. It kind of lets you know the bees are happy with what you got and you're helping out the ecosystem. Kerrigan didn't switch to regenerative agriculture because he wanted more bees. He did it because 6 years ago, he was worried about feeding his cattle. We were in some wet years, he says. What we were growing, barley and oats, kept drowning. So we got the idea to try something else. He attributes the better water management in the soil now to having more active root systems in the soil and having cover crops like alfalfa or clover that are grown for the enrichment of the soil. Background on how they do that. These plants are nitrogen fixing. So instead of putting more carbon or carbon out and carbon in the soil, it's putting in nitrogen. Because two things are needed for life to occur, carbon and nitrogen. That is what we are both made up of, as well as all living things. And the thing about most fertilizer is about putting nitrogen back in the soil. So if you have cover crops doing that, you don't need to use oil-based fertilizer and oil-based petrochemicals and pesticides. Some cover crops are grown all year. Dancy, who moved to the farm 3 years ago, says that mixing the crops in the field also allowed them to harvest the mixed rations they need to feed their cattle. She estimates it now takes probably a third of the time to get the feed in front of the cows. She says the new method had also made the farm more money. When you get higher quality feed to the animal, then that obviously comes through the milk side of it. And they talk about the milk and how it's better, though I personally believe, and I think this is the facts backed it up, that we shouldn't be drinking cow's milk. It's not really for us. Just kind of pointing that out. The new farming system and increased number of bees has attracted the attention of General Mills, maker of Cheerios, and a lot of other products. This is all important to rebuild the soil health from areas where we source the ingredients, says Eckberg. General Mills is a research agronomist. He said that GM is interested in regenerative agriculture as well for the sustainability of their supply chain. So capital will react properly when the bottom line is certainly hit, and the bottom line is most definitely being hit by climate collapse, climate change, more wet years, as the farmer put it. So when they absolutely have to, they will do the right thing, but they absolutely have to. But it has to be in the short term. Wet years, not flooding amongst decades and fires that rage for a century. All of these practices can be implemented whether you're in Texas or Saskatchewan. And that's the end of that one. Let's see. Here's another one about growing food and its more radical potential. RealPharmacy.com reports, why growing food is the single most impactful thing you can do in a corrupt political system. So let's get more structural, shall we? The more effective change makers in our society aren't waiting around for a new president to make their life better. They're planting seeds, quite literally, and through the revolutionary act of gardening. And that is a meme about permaculture, that it's revolution disguised as gardening. They're rebuilding their communities while growing their own independence. Every 4 years, so don't rely on General Mills. Every 4 years, when the big election comes around, millions of people put their passion for creating a better world into an increasingly corrupt and absurd political contest. The simple act of growing our own food directly challenges the control matrix in many authentic ways, which is why some of the most forward-thinking and strongest-willed people are picking up shovels and defiantly starting gardens. It has become much more of a meaningful political statement than supporting political parties and candidates. Propaganda gardening, a combination of guerrilla gardening and political protest, is about developing self-sufficiency while making a simple, yet bold statement about the world we all share and the rules we choose to live by. So it's not just about doing what feels good, but doing it consciously and promoting it as such. Just as how me doing the show in a community-run radio station is not just the conscious choice of doing being part of a community project, but pointing out that we need to control our own media if we are to control our own destinies. Take, for example, Ron Finley, the guerrilla gardener from L.A., who inspires the world with no-nonsense truth about how the corporate food system enslaves us, or proving to us that the most effective weapon in this fight is fertile soil. He makes growing veggies cool again, and it should be, because food sovereignty is the very foundation of personal independence. Quoting him, I live in a food prison. It's all by design, just like the prisons are designed. I just got tired of being an inmate, so I figured, let me change this paradigm. Let me grow my own food. This is the one thing I can do to escape this predestined life that I've unwillingly subscribed to. Back to the writer. Think about it. Creating our own food supply challenges the status quo in a number of important ways. It decreases your dependence on a polluted corporate food system. It improves health and wellness by providing exercise and nutritious food, freeing us from dependence on a for-profit medical system. It undermines Monsanto, also now Bayer, and the agrochemical industry that is polluting our world and killing bees. It also helps restore ecology to save bees. Builds and heals community, providing a place and activity worth coming together over, instead of just public meetings. Works to repair the damage we are doing to the environment with our consumer lifestyles. It protects us against insecurity and food unrest. So for the liberals, who just want to prevent unrest at all costs. So they're, you know, support the police state and whatever. Facilitates a greater awakening by setting an example for others to follow. When united, awareness and action create the kind of changes that a rigid control system cannot tolerate. And when extraordinary people like Ron Finley take the lead, a meaningful movement can take hold. This is real action. It is very effective, and as it becomes more mainstream to set up gardens in your yard or on your block, we are witness to a reemergence of the kind of society we just cannot create by playing by the rules of a rigged system. He says, I had 60 people putting in an urban garden while you were all marching. Now, who do you think was more effective? Here's Ron in the recent interview with Mark Angelo of the Superhero Academy. Just a few generations ago, gardening for subsistence was not the fringe activity that it was become in recent decades, because it was a basic daily act of survival. One that will rise again as a controlled economy and engineered economic collapse will make it imperative to join forces with your community and defend your personal sovereignty. Why don't you churches get together instead of your "my religion is better than yours" bullshit? Get together and put in a healthy food market. Isn't that doing good business? If your people live longer, don't you get more money? Since many, many community activists seem to be obsessed with people having their own businesses and kind of individualistic entrepreneurship. Back to the article. What happens when you transform yourself by deepening your connection to nature? What happens when you then transform your community by bringing your neighbors together in the goal of providing something of immense value to all? What happens when a nation of transformed communities sees their world without the boundaries of and the limitations imposed on us by a corrupt system? The four-year cycle of presidential politics in the U.S. is far more effective at stealing the constructive energy of motivated people than it is at bringing about meaningful change to our lives, communities, and to the nation as a whole. Because after all, if we are independent of national government, we can defend ourselves against corporate rule, we can control and organize our own means of electricity, water supply. Federal government, state government becomes obsolete. It's a long project, but it's a project worth conceiving of. Let's overgrow the system and transform our health and communities in the process. For a sign that this movement is spreading across the nation, check out this homegrown music video, "Gardening is Gangsta," by Mark Jenkins and Simpha Paul Davis. Now, I did watch this. I will not subject you to it. I think it's actually quite cringy. So, onward and upward. I guess I'll spend the last 10 minutes just talking about, not reading, because it's more of a technical kind of thing. From Low Tech Magazine, I really love this publication. It's really just a blog from one guy, so he updates very infrequently. But when he does update, it is a treasure trove of good information, of alternatives to kinds of problems I've described in episodes past. But in episodes past, I've talked about how even renewable energy as an industrial process is extractive. It depends on rare earth minerals that have even yet to be mined. And that's not even including ecological damage to both nature and communities, which nature too, from current mining for minerals and metals for, you know, renewable energy, windmills, solar panels, to really replace the energy grid, the amount of power we currently use, which is very, very wasteful. There's waste on every level of it. Not even talking about individual homes. Changing your light bulbs is not enough. It never was enough. So the article is called "How to Make Wind Power Sustainable Again." Rather than reading all of it out, he basically points out that we've had windmills for thousands of years that weren't made of electromagnets and blah, 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 blah. And whatever GE does, and whatever GE makes, points out that many windmill blades, the industrial windmill blades, are made of they're basically made of non-recyclable materials. They could be made of steel, which can be, you know, melted down and reused, but a lot of them are used of fiberglass, and fiberglass is non-recyclable, and plastic and other petroleum products. They don't have to be. They could be made of wood. They could be made of treated wood. He points out all the types of wooden windmills and just how there are all these experiments with windmill blades. The blades themselves seem to be the main contention of what are they made of, that they need to be made of something that is, in fact, recyclable. So he goes through a bunch of turn of the 20th century experiments in Holland and Britain with windmill blades of various designs to maximize the power you get from a wooden type of design. The size matters of the blade. Bigger blades are better. Could be reinforced steel, carbon fiber. An industry that calls itself sustainable and renewable cannot send millions of tons of plastic waste to landfills each year, which it currently does. So consequently, could we revert to building wind turbine blades from recyclable materials alone? And how large could we build them? To which extent? So I'm really just kind of vamping about this. Let's see. He mentions laminated veneer lumber, in which the wood is peeled off the tree and then glued back together in thin layers. It's a wood product that appeared in the 80s and which has an important advantage in relation to solid wood components. Consistency of wood could vary within a single tree. Therefore, the length of a wood spar used in a pre-industrial windmill was limited by the availability of large trunks. But with veneer lumber, you can basically make wood as strong, as long as you want. That is what makes kind of high rises made out of wood possible. And they can also be treated for fire. Or we could just go smaller and just have more windmill blades. So all the different ways of making them recyclable, unlike today with the, you know, growing amount of wind power generation, all of these wind turbines, their blades are not recyclable, made of fiberglass. Not good. And we couldn't do better. We can do better. So in previous episodes, you know, I talked about how, like, you know, either we just need to put limits. We can't really have this renewable energy economy. Now, we technically can. That's kind of why I'm sharing this information. So it's kind of a little bit of both for me. You know, we both have to impose limits. We need to be more efficient. How we use power needs to be based on community benefit, ecological benefit. And part of that is when we do create power using renewables, it needs to be recyclable. Currently, the products created by capitalist industry are not, because by default, they don't care about recycling things. It is an afterthought. It is an extra industry to create later to solve a problem that the industrial system creates. And that's a theme I constantly harp about. Another thing to mention is on the 21st of September, there is the climate strike. Look up where the nearest climate strike is to you. And I think in the break, I will look up a story so I can talk about that at length. So I'll just stop with that. Let's go to the housekeeping for this hour. A reminder that word of mouth is the best thing you do in growing this show, and input from you in what I can do better, which I certainly know I can. Leave a review on our podcast platforms and do what you can to increase our reach. Share the Three Lefts with your chosen media platform. I'm currently on Facebook and Twitter, Three Left Show. The show is also podcasted, not just live radio. It is podcasted via most mainstream podcasting apps. It is on Stitcher. It is on iTunes. It is on Google Play. Support the show more materially, you can visit our Patreon page. Become a member there. Money raised there goes to promotions. Links are currently found in the description of each podcast episode, but for the most part, all links and sources can be found on the posts for each episode at the website threelefts.news, where I also have other resources, descriptions, archive of all past episodes, and just general why am I doing this and how and what.
Can't you see at this pace we're losing steam? We digress right to the seed of our conviction. And so clearly we see the signs in the thousands of misused lives. So will you speak your mind or become the oppression? And we all feel the heartache that comes with time. And we now see a bigger picture. Why can't you listen to the reason the people are dying for this revolution to free them? The cities are burning, the skies are on fire with anticipation to just kill the system. Let's call this earth our own. Does this not scream out that we're wasting away our vision? A bountiful, abundant life are given right in ourselves to survive. Will we give up our
Okay, let's just return to the show. Hello, welcome to live and in studio, the Three Left Show with your host, me, Dan Platt, know-it-all activist, insecure in his uncertainty. Or, no, secure in his uncertainty, insecure in his paralysis of thinking that the project I'm doing isn't really the right project. There's all these other projects that I'm jealous that I'm not part of, but I just need to be content with what I'm doing and take the compliments as they come. Like, yeah, Dan, I do like what you're doing. Oh, yeah, so to follow up on the no-name eco-socialist no-name tweeter story, here is a tweet from a Dioreka, like Erica, but with a D. She tweets, follow up on kind of blackpreneur, black millionaires. Jay-Z rapped that he arrived on the day Fred Hampton died. Hampton, a Black Panther Party leader, murdered by the police, insisted, "We say you don't fight capitalism with no black capitalism. You fight capitalism with socialism." Well said. So I just talked about renewable energy, especially the kind that actually is made up of machinery that is recyclable. Unorganized way, but here is a motherboard story that is, you know, Vice's tech side. Workers seize the shipyard that built the Titanic, plan to make renewable energy there. The closure of the last shipyard in Belfast, Ireland, would mean end centuries of shipbuilding in the city. A group of workers are demanding the UK nationalize the yards. By Lauren Kyrie Gurley. Last month, 130 shipbuilders, steelworkers, welders, and riveters seized control of the storied Belfast shipyard that built the Titanic in 1909 as a claim to fame, but of course it built a million other ships. More than 2 weeks later, they're still there and say they won't be leaving until the docks are nationalized and are used to produce renewable energy infrastructure. This is also what seizing the means looks like. Workers seizing the means of production. Because obviously they can't use the means without capital and inputs, and you don't get inputs without a proper owner. So they basically are asking for public ownership. The docks had moved to shut down after their troubled Norwegian parent company, Dolphin Drilling, failed to find a buyer. But militant workers have refused to relinquish the site, including the two towering yellow cranes known as Samson and Goliath, landmarks that dominate the Belfast skyline. The closure of the shipyard, once an emblem of Britain's industrial power with over 30,000 workers, would mark the end of centuries of shipbuilding in the city. But workers from Harlan and Wolff are demanding that Prime Minister Boris Johnson nationalize the shipyards and create new jobs in renewable energy there. "I was there yesterday. These workers are going to sit there until they get a result," a spokesperson for Unite, which represents Harlan and Wolff workers, told Motherboard. "There's massive potential in wind turbines and tidal energy. They're saying they could create thousands of jobs, and that we need a just transition to renewable energy. That's what the Green New Deal is all about, nationalizing these industrial centers and doing exactly what these workers want." Oh, wait, it says that itself. "Some activists involved in the occupation have cited the Green New Deal as their inspiration. In recent years, the workers at Harlan and Wolff have built parts for wind turbines. They argue that renewable energy jobs would serve not only a sustainable solution, but also a practical one because of their skill set. No need for retraining." The steel workers, now in their 17th day of protest, have blocked insolvency practitioners, known in the UK as administrators, from entering the site, with around 20 to 30 workers occupying around the clock. "No one moves onto the site or off that site unless the workers who are running that site agree to it," a union official told the media. "No administrator will drive into that workplace unless the gate is opened by workers." Now, here in America, this doesn't really happen because there would be a massive police involvement. There was a strike in which basically a picket is usually made ineffective because the police will enforce access to private property. So you try to picket it, you try to block access, the police will remove you by force. So usually pickets just become standing protests outside of a property that are not really disrupting the business as usual. unless you really dig in, which I'm assuming has happened here, though I don't know what the local government's response is and why the police, say, aren't charging in with their riot shields and their tear gas to, say, gas out these workers. But in Europe, there's just a different culture of things. And in America, private property rights always come first. And that means the police crack heads. But that happens in Europe, too. So I'm unsure what the context is that allows this kind of protest, this occupation of the worksite, to continue. I'm going to chalk it up to moxie and that they actually have a defensive position, that they are in the site and they're not leaving. Jerry Carroll, an outspoken member of the Northern Ireland's Parliament for Ireland's Socialist Party, People Before Profits, has teamed up with local unions to call for green energy jobs at Harlan and Wolff. Carroll says the Belfast Docks have a long history of labor strikes and worker purges dating back to the 1910s and into the 90s, during the Northern Ireland conflict. Catholics have been forced out of jobs. There is a poisonous history of anti-communism, Carroll told Motherboard. We fully support the workers in their occupation and fight. And that's the end of that. Here's another one from Europe about achieving actual sustainability. How Copenhagen plans to reach carbon neutral status in just 6 years. Now that is the kind of timeline I like to see. And they got serious about going carbon neutral like 15 years ago. Really good head start, but they were serious about it, unlike our cities. Many cities are aiming for neutrality by 2030. Yeah, right. Or 2050. But their goals are still like 80% or something. The Danish capital plans to be the first carbon neutral capital in the world to hit this goal by 2025. Now, in case you don't have your global geography certificate, Copenhagen is the capital of Denmark. If you miss the metro as you walk up to the stop in central Copenhagen during rush hour, you won't wait long for the next train. The automated system is designed to run every 2 minutes. It's one way for the city to convince residents not to drive. And as the metro system expands, one small piece of the city's ambitious plan to cut emissions. 6 years ago, the city of Copenhagen set the goal to become the first carbon-neutral capital city in the world. Shrinking energy use as it shifts to renewables and produces enough extra green power to offset other remaining emissions. It plans to reach the goal by 2025, while some other cities, including DC, are aiming as late as 2050. So far, it has cut emissions 42%, nearly halfway there. The city leaders believe it is on track to hit the target. The city is working to become one of the world's greenest and most bike-friendly cities, says the Lord Mayor. This is the best way forward because it creates better space, cleaner air, less noise, healthier people. Frank Jensen is the mayor there. One piece of the strategy is to improve transportation. In Nordhav, an industrial neighborhood that is transforming into a sustainable district of homes and offices, that means making everything accessible. We created a new vision for transportation, the 5-minute city, we called it. That means that the city is planned in a way that it only takes you 5 minutes to walk from your apartment to a kindergarten, shops, or other public amenities. The project director in Rambo, an engineering and design company that worked on the strategy for the district. Anyone in the neighborhood will also be a short walk from the new metro line that will open next year. It means that people won't bother to take their car. It's more convenient to bike, walk, or take public transit than to go to a central parking garage. Buildings don't have garages of their own and also drive around looking for parking at their destination. The mayor also wants to restrict polluting cars from some areas. I really want to provide new road traffic initiatives so that we get cleaner air. Imagine such a proactive politician. The former government was not ambitious regarding the green agenda. And by the way, something different in Denmark is that they have a robust Green Party and a multi-party parliamentary system. So yeah, just better liberal democracy, which allows for the kind of democratic socialism that makes these things possible. As oppressive it still is, it's still capitalism, but it's still worlds better. For a movie version of this, check out Michael Moore's, let's see, it was his movie, Who Do We Invade Next, I believe it's called. To shrink the carbon footprint and its electricity use, Copenhagen is shifting to renewables. Today it has installed all the wind turbines, yada yada yada. Oh, yes. There's also the trash to garbage. There's the trash to electricity plant, which I learned about. It was designed by architecture firm VIG because it also has a big ski slope on it, which brings in extra revenue because it's like a big industrial building. Another plant now runs on wood pellets instead of coal to produce heat. Harvesting vast amounts of forest to make the wood pellets isn't exactly... It's called biomass, and I've covered that previously, where biomass is actually... maybe it's less, you know, polluting as coal, but it's still producing carbon, and it's still kind of carbon CO2 emissions. It's actually just as bad, or at least it's not really helping. He's hoping that Copenhagen's work will give other cities an example to follow as they move in the same direction. Copenhagen's eco-friendly district heating, our clean harbor, our biking culture could be copied in other cities, says Jensen. We insist on green solutions because it pays off. I think that's a very important message to send to mayors around the world. Copenhagen's green transformation goes hand in hand with job creation, growing economy, and a much better quality of life. Not quite revolutionary, but yeah, it's, that goes out to all you non-revolutionaries who just need to push harder if you want, say, this, reformist, you know, just prove your reformism to be the correct path and show me. You know, if Albany and other American cities, New York City even, was like Copenhagen, then your reformist arguments would have more merit with me. But here in America, it seems to be too slow, too little, too late, and not enough, as well as not helping with the structural solutions. Denmark has its nationalist party, too. Denmark, its wealth kind of depends on various things. Global economy that oppresses billions. You know, it's still Europe, and Europe, its wealth and development was borrowed time and stolen resources, just to be a little Debbie Downer about it. So, but here is a more revolutionary take on ecology, social ecology, outlined by a anarchist philosopher, Murray Bookchin. So this is from It's Going Down, place for Antifa news and whatnot, but this is from Demand Utopia, another kind of grassroots radical grouping organization. It's titled, Can We Come Post-Fascism? A Demand Utopia Report Back. Now, Demand Utopia has taken on a certain aesthetic. Those kind of ski masks that cover your entire head and face. They wear those, but they're neon green. Kind of a almost puke green. but it's a neon green, very visible, very unique. Taken from the aesthetic of the Zapatistas. I'll cover them in a different episode. So here's a report from Demand Utopia on their call for a wave of actions during Green June, but they're rolling actions that happen every month, pretty much. And their actions are actually quite a mix of things. Sometimes they're not very radical at all. Sometimes they're actually just kind of a banner and sign wave outside a particular corporate target. But they're corporate targets that aren't targeted by your usual NGOs. So this is a report back that's, you know, mid-summer, but it's still very relevant. Last month in June, Demand Utopia called for another wave of action titled Green June or Operation Rooted Seedling. This call to action was a follow-up on our previous actions in solidarity with Make Rojava Green Again campaign and the Internationalist Commune of Rojava. The revolution of Rojava is anti-fascist and is ecological. The ideology of democratic confederalism, intertwined with social ecology, in Rojava has rooted in the philosophy of social ecology. Social ecology stands as the original eco-anarchist and communalist perspective. It has, from the beginning, positioned itself as both sternly anti-fascist and ecological. Today, as the issue of climate change is increasingly being viewed with a sense of urgency, we must demand that organizations tackle this issue holistically in order not to fall victim to the fascist creep. So a little background on the word communalist there. So communalism is the word for, it's a good stand-in for the kind of, I don't want to say cop-out, but a communism of the 21st century. Communism has all the baggage of 20th century and current socialist states. But the socialists, especially anarchist-leaning socialists like myself, I like the word communism. I use the word communism. I'm not afraid to use the word communism, but a lot of people don't like it. Has a lot of baggage. Has a lot of other meanings. And in Facebook arguments, when I do describe what I'm for, the well-read person says, like, oh, you're a communalist, not a communist. Like, there's a little difference to me. Communalism is simply the 21st century libertarian slash anarchist leaning alternative slash evolution of the practice of socialism. Socialism in the 21st century is bottom up. It is based on community power and all of these community projects climbing together. The growing of gardens, the things I've described, the unions that occupy their workplaces and don't give them up to capital power because a corporate owner couldn't find a buyer. So I guess those jobs are just not going to be there anymore. Bullcrap. Don't take it. That is unacceptable, right? We don't have to take that lying down. So that falls under the rubric of communalism. And those other word salad kind of things, social ecology, democratic confederalism. As the reality of climate disaster continues to unfold, it is imperative that we understand it is rooted in our social problems. Otherwise, even more brutal forms of fascism are guaranteed to arise in the future. Seizing upon society's highly problematic views of nature and future ecological disasters to justify even deeper Malthusian population reduction projects, especially as climate change denialism becomes increasingly impossible. Ultimately, for us, there is only one solution, social revolution. And not political revolution. Sorry, Sanders folks. Two threats, one solution. Today, our world faces two primary threats, the threat of global fascism and the threat of ecological cataclysm. As social ecologists, eco-anarchists, and communalists, all of these things dovetail with that eco-socialism that I mentioned in the past hour as well. They're not mutually exclusive at any rate. The domination of humanity over nature is rooted in the domination of human over human. Therefore, if we ever hope to solve our ecological crisis, we must first solve the societal one. Fascism, then as now, is birthed via the mass alienation and individualization of millions of people from communal and pre-capitalist social structures. You know, the village. As they are shoved towards a disempowerment, a uncertain, dreamlike life within the capitalist machine. So what's described here is like, you know, village culture, village being, village communism even. And thus the contradiction between others who said they're like, they talk about community, they do community projects because, oh, it takes a village to raise a child. That's what Hillary Clinton said. But that kind of work is in direct opposition to the neoliberal order. So it's really quite empty rhetoric when a neoliberal politician talks about community and grassroots activism and things. That's why it's kind of, it pains me, and I feel like they're spinning their wheels, and although they're doing good in these little pockets, they're surrounded, they are under siege and under threat, and their good work can be undone. Like that. Or with a wave of government wands. Capitalism has disempowered millions to live life subject to systems and structures we are told are too powerful to change, or too big to fail. Shut out of meaningful decision-making over society, we begin a forced retreat from the world, as we are coerced by police, artificial scarcity, and increasingly physically separated from society. Due to the enclosure of the commons, a self-sustaining complacency takes hold, a surrender resulting in an eventual loss of any understanding of the meaning of life itself, and eventually the will to live, and thus a turning to death cults and the mass shooter lifestyle. The death cult of fascism enters with the answer of collective surrender. It is a brutalistic embrace of the faulty pseudo-Darwinian notion of survival of the fittest, and claims that competition and conflict between difference are fundamental biological and spiritual facts. It peddles fictitious nostalgias of the good old days, of cultural traditions, of urban recension, which looks at cities as morally depraved melting pots to be destroyed while embracing competition and capitalist modernity before fellow humans. Hitler, to do a little Godwin's Law, equivocated the cosmopolitan with the Semitic. It is within these mythological roots that the identity of whiteness evolved, the religious mythology of manifest destiny, and Hitler's Lebensraum. Ultimately, all of this comes together to envision a future unchanging, self-sustaining, conflictless, functional social system that just needs to remove the undesirables to realize its happy dystopia. Now, if you're ever watching Fox News or right-wing commentators or even moderate commentators who decry cities or rather pump up rural people without actually supporting rural workers and rural people living there, you know, by cutting their social support and whatnot. Yes, they are on the down low being anti-Semitic and anti-minority, right? And by being anti-cosmopolitan, by saying, like, there's something wrong with cities. They're corrupt. They're liberals. They're latte drinkers. It's all code and dog whistles. Yes, they are being racist. They are being anti-Semitic. It's just very camouflaged, as well as it's the foundation of their edifice of the rhetoric that they use. So let's have a call. So back to the article. Ecological anti-fascism. Because this is kind of a report back in a statement. We, as social ecologists, instead point to examples of symbiotic relationships, eco-communities, and interdependence within first nature. Conceptual name of the non-human natural world. Second nature is then the nature that we cultivate and exert influence on. To express the potential for cooperation as an underlying principle of evolution. This vision of nature is known both to modern ecologists and evolutionists, and has been well understood by the philosopher Kropotkin in the early 1800s. Instead of overemphasizing our differences, we prioritize what we have in common. We understand that as human animals are as natural as any other. Our unique attributes, as with all other species, are the product of our evolution. Indeed, through these processes, we have evolved great gifts, such as self-consciousness, the capacity to make ethical judgments, creativity to shape the world around us, to make us exceptionally unique when compared to other species. However, due to this, we also possess unique abilities to be cruel, to cause harm to others, simply for our own pleasure. Today, we understand humanity is trapped by its own creative destruction, its own bifurcation between its first and its second nature. So this is also a different way of talking about human nature, that there's a first nature, that of instinct and what have you, and the second nature of our consciousness and our ability to make ethical judgments, to take charge of our own destinies and decide, I want to reduce harm. I want to increase human well-being. For humanity to transcend this state society must bind itself to first nature and not exploit it. Humanity as a whole must enter a form of social and biotic relations, some would call third or free nature. This will not happen on its own. We are discovering a common ecological ethic that recognizes humanity as a self-conscious manifestation of the natural world's drive towards greater self-understanding, its complexity, its diversity. As stewards of the land, human nature, thus, is only evolution and change, a constant state of becoming. We hope the persistent and constant appeal for a free society, for a new ecological life, will help to cast relief for the utopias to come. We know only that the potential exists and that brute competition, fascism, and exploitation are aspects of a capitalist society that can be rooted out of our resistance. In this way, we understand fascism to always be ecocidal, no matter what ideological veneer that it has taken in the past, or will take in the future. It is rooted in stasis, whereas life is rooted in change. It is a death cult in pursuit of fantastical natural order and unchanging natural laws. Whether Darwinian, quote-unquote, capitalism, competition, or the racial competition and struggle of Nazism. To avoid the strain of the fascist creep, we all must understand there is nowhere to return to. There is no pure past that we can emulate. Nature itself does not have some untouched beginning we should recreate. We have always only known nature through society. Today the world is swept by cultural xenophobias. As people, we are coerced in becoming disempowered individuals. We are forced to develop static, individualized identities in this spectacular avatar realm of online representations, selling ourselves as commodities in both the workplace and the inescapable social sphere. Now, this is all just an academic / well-read version of saying that, well, basically the complaints about social media, how it, you know, it's false reality. I can't live up to the hype of other people. You know, any critique of, you know, crass consumerism and what have you, that's what this is talking about. It's just a different and perhaps a more meta way of talking about it. So it gets beyond the day-to-day complaints and more towards what the real problem is and what can be done about it. For light to continue, we must be allowed to leave our old static selves behind, yet in this process together discover what we always truly were. What so many movements of past have given their lives fighting for us to be freely become. We do not live satisfied, pleasurable lives until there is a free society, free humanity. For we are not separable from it. As Fred Hampton Jr., that I already quoted already, once exulted in his famous speech, we have to keep identifying ourselves with the revolutionary process of change while being simultaneously aligned with people against the death machine. Let's say it together. I am a revolutionary. Now what can be done? As social ecologists, we have a developmental view of humanity. Humanity is a process. Our very existence is change. We call this analysis a dialectical naturalism. Because there is no predetermined course of history, revolution won't come out of thin air or be sparked. It also won't inevitably arise due to environmental crisis or cataclysm. Revolution, rather than an event or a moment, is a process too. It will only be built, collectively willed into being by conscious, self-conscious people who have the aim to transform themselves and the social relations and those structures towards actualizing their that potential for cooperation, like co-ops, in small part. The ecological crisis has the potential to unite humanity to realize a new free society through a new internationalist urgency to solve the problem. We can work towards local, regional food sovereignty to build locally controlled and democratic material structures, you know, literally like the guerrilla gardening talked about before. Yeah, so it's basically the academic version of what I've already kind of gone over, but I do like the poetic, you know, manifesto language of this. It's a more holistic and total kind of statement about what is to be done, instead of just going bit by bit with the gardens, the transportation, the industrial workplace. So, you know, I'm trying to bring you both sides and bring it together. And so they describe their June actions. Demand Utopia in Portland announced the creation of an urban farm. We inherited the farm from a past project and began by doubling its size with the addition of several new beds. We plan to use the produce for community mutual aid with the houseless. Currently, we are working with other groups in the area to begin building a radical network of urban farms. That's the group in Portland. The group in Neighbors from the Plant in Tallahassee, Florida, joined the call in prepping seed bombs and dropping them around the area. Seed bomb is where you like make a, you take a bunch of wildflower seeds and you make a big kind of soil ball with some compost, which doesn't smell. And you basically make a ball and you basically half bury it. So it's sticking out of the ground, and then basically boom, wildflower boom, bloom. Good way of, because weeds and wildflowers or weeds are adept at growing, cleaning contaminated soil and just generally bring ecosystems back. And of course, they're good for pollinators. Bring back bees. Let's see. What Santa Cruz do? The Utopians of Santa Cruz gave away seeds and live starts, you know, the little saplings, of beans and sunflowers during a really free market at the Sabrosa community space. Good on them. Let's see. The group in Montreal, neighbors in a squatted community garden, hosted a workshop around permaculture, as mentioned before, to promote food autonomy in an urban context. The plot of land the garden is on is privately owned by a speculator seizing the land. Due to its negligent use, it was occupied by the neighborhood gardeners. Today, they are working towards full community control of the land there. And that's the kind of campaigns we need to really disrupt the status quo in Rust Belt cities like mine. We need to stop relying on the slow wheels of justice through the law and municipal government to get off its collective posteriors. And we need to just start occupying vacant buildings, but not just squatting in the shadows, but doing so as a public campaign, going public to draw attention to the failures against the vacant housing crisis we have here in my city, where there is over 100 vacant buildings, many of which are not totally wrecked, but are salvageable. But you see, there's a current issue here. So respect for private property, basically. The city hasn't even inspected some of these vacant buildings to even know if they are easily renovatable or whatever. But they have a red X on them just to show that they could be dangerous. But they don't even know or not. Why? And they haven't inspected them because they don't legally have permission to. They need permission from the owner, and the owner either can't be found, or when they are found, they are negligent, they're absentee, they live a state away, and they say, that's an infringement of my privacy. I live there sometimes. I think that was the case of this one property in the newspaper I saw. And man, does it just make you shake your head. And just like with this, you know, the speculator, just start with the bank-owned and the speculator-owned land. Just occupy it, start using it, and then demand the city recognize your ownership of it. That's leverage. Not protesting and going to public meetings, but occupying the land, taking ownership of it, as if you already owned it. And then, with that, gain leverage. And of course, the benefits of, say, community gardens and whatever you would do with that land. Even if you're just housing some homeless people. Okay, because you know what's unsafe? All right, not delinquent vacant buildings. I mean, it could be unsafe, right? A lot of mold. But you know what's really unsafe? Living on the streets. I am related, right? Not directly, but I'm related. I'm a little closer than others to the deaths of homeless people on the streets. That's what's dangerous. That's what's agonizingly outrageous about putting private property rights over the common good. Moving on with the hit parade. Demand Utopia, Seattle, joined a work group at the Beacon Food Forest with comrades from Extinction Rebellion in Seattle, as well as the Seattle Socialist Rifle Association and a Revolutionary's Garden. So it was a really big collective effort there. And by the way, this article here has pictures and videos of these actions and whatever, what have you. And here is a video from Make Rojava Green Again and the Internationalist Commune that joined a call sending in a video of solidarity, previewing the ecological restoration projects that they are currently working on. Let's see. Inspired by the call to action, the June one, the London Mutual Aid Collective from Connecticut expropriated the land in a neighborhood desolated and abandoned by capitalism. The collective started planting fruit trees and other fruit-bearing plants. Very nice. That, you know, where there wasn't a forest before, build a forest, bringing it back around. Let's see, another post from Seattle. We're put in contact with members from the Dinewish tribe who asked them to organize a work group to prepare the area for gardening, help develop it as a space for members of the community to reconnect with nature. So I think that's the same action I mentioned before. Joining in a few weeks later are friends from the Democratic Confederalist Commune. In Illinois, shared their photos of their raised planter beds of their urban garden. So it's just a network of grassroots gardeners and various other things. But over the course of the summer, I saw a post from a Demand Utopia cell. I'm going to call them cells. They did a little demo of, you know, like six people with some signs, but they did a demo outside a weapons manufacturer. Boeing. It was Boeing. Maker of nuclear missiles and various other weapons of mass destruction. Ending terrorism starts at home. Okay, in the last 5 minutes, I'm going to turn it back around. I talked about unrest and in the context of Hong Kong. I don't know if this is too useful here. So, with the time remaining, I'm going to mention something. The direct impact of the riot and just unrest itself, that it has some impacts, positive impacts on working class people. And it is not just destructive in a way. So this is from Bloomberg News. Hong Kong rents set to fall as protests curb housing demand. Isn't that a fascinating title? Hong Kong housing rents are set to decline as anti-government protests continue to rock the city because it is general unrest, these protests. They take many forms with many different demands. Some of the protesters are cutting down the surveillance poles with their facial recognition machines on them. Very cool. Some protests are pro-Beijing and do want the socialist state to bring the hammer down on abusive capitalists and landlords. If that is their means, if that is the result, though it most likely won't be. Sometimes they're just, they are protesting their local Hong Kong government, which is, of course, very capitalist, very liberalizing, and thus working people, middle class people, are just squeezed in a ton of directions. So let's get into that. Real estate professionals forecast rents in Hong Kong's main island, home to the central business district, will fall 2% in the next year, according to a survey conducted by the Royal Institute of Surveyors. That's a reversal from the 3% gain forecast in previous surveys, which was held just as large-scale protests started in June. The recent events serve as a tangible reminder that Hong Kong has 28 years of one country, two systems remaining, that during that time there is potential for significant upheaval. So one country, two systems is that Hong Kong is still basically ruled by a capitalist superstructure versus the state socialists of China. The government that, despite its human rights abuses, no denying them, does build more solar power energy than in 1 year than we've ever had, as well as provide, you know, free medical clinics and a bunch of other social services and things. And it's very slow with the labor rights. I'm not going to get into that, but yeah, it's a mixed bag for sure. This could trigger a third wave of overseas immigration, as many in Hong Kong hold overseas passports already. Wealthy ones, anyway. But I don't think we're at that point yet. Residential rents climbed almost 8% in 2 years through June to be near a record high. Hong Kong's hopeless, and links to an article, Hong Kong's hopeless generation has a long list of grievances. So it's not just Beijing and their extradition law. It isn't just, we don't want the mainland government bringing in its socialism, right? It's not just an anti-socialist movement. I mean, it's not really one movement. It is unrest. And unrest is a representation of the general problems of the society overall. So it's, as one commentator in Italy called it, it's blind protest. There's no, and her alternative to that is having a project. Demand Utopia and all those other urban gardeners, they have a project. And as that one guerrilla gardener said, you know, you marched, but I fed people. The city is the most expensive in the world in which to rent a mid-range two-bedroom apartment. Mapping the World Prices report at $3,600 a month. The cost is 27% more than you'd pay in New York. But weeks of protests, which have morphed from opposing an extradition bill into a mass repudiation of China's hold over Hong Kong, as Bloomberg puts it, but it's way more than that, are starting to bite the city's property market. Office vacancy rates in Central climbed to a 3-year high last month. another link to another article, hitting tycoons where it hurts could appease Hong Kong protesters. Continuing on with this, though. The increase in severity of the protests appear to be weighing on the rental market. The rents still appear to be more resilient than prices. The protests do remain the main concern of survey participants, with several respondents highlighting it as a persistent downside risk. The survey received 150 responses, mostly from chartered surveyors working in the property industry. Home sales have also been hit. The amount of residential property trade in July fell 35%. Ouch! If you are a property investor, but good if you are a working person. So I just thought that was pretty neat in the context of trying to have a more holistic position on pro-Hong Kong protests or pro-socialist state China, which, because life is more messy and complicated than that, than just a pro or con or two sides. Why do I mention this? Because our government, U.S. State Department, Trump administration overall, neocons and neolibs are attempting or putting in their effort to influence the Hong Kong protests. They meet with youth leaders and are generally spending money through NGOs, which generally gives China the well-related, the justifiable excuse that they're cracking down on these protests as a form of defending their sovereignty, as the U.S. is trying to create a beachhead of sorts. The CIA extensively uses the Hong Kong as their Chinese listening post. And generally it's a lack of respect. So that's one side of it, which, you know, when I first started, you know, trying to pay attention to what are these Hong Kong protests, I kind of my first glance, the first articles I saw were about CIA and American NGO involvement. And how these leaders of these protest movements are meeting with the State Department, going to the embassy. It's starting to look like the Venezuelan coup or some kind of American-fueled unrest, like in Ukraine, which now has very interesting but very right-wing and fascist, neo-fasc-dominated parliament. That's the kind of government political revolution that U.S. NGOs instigate. So, I'm for not happening in Hong Kong. But, it's been pointed out by other commentators and other news sources, beyond just the kind of more pro-Chinese ones, that this unrest has a lot in common with the Yellow Vests. Are there right-wing opportunists and others there? Yes. But there are also a lot of left-wingers. There's a lot of populist demands coming out of it. As a lot of populist action, the destruction of surveillance equipment from a sense of lawlessness. But the law comes in a few forms, and for the most part, in our current global context, the law comes in the form of a boot on one's neck, or the censorship and the restriction of human rights in the name of security. And just as it's usually security from terrorists, Islamic or otherwise, or even right-wing terrorists in the coming decade, in the form of, you know, gun control and whatnot, in the name of protecting us from climate crisis and the natural disasters, expect more police state activities towards that, with the purpose of protecting private property over human lives, as well as the collected wealth of billionaires and millionaires collected from the exploitation of nature that has created this crisis in the first place. So with that downer note, but I'm just more to just be aware of it. But there is something to do about it. Create unrest. Blessed unrest is the title of one book on my shelf. So with that, I'll sign off. This has been the Three Left Show. I've been your host, Dan Platt. Thank you very much for listening. And be well. We'll be right back.